Hello. Welcome to the Positive Energy Podcast, the official podcast of the University of Ottawa's Positive Energy Initiative. We seek to strengthen public confidence in Canadian energy policy, regulation, and decision-making through evidence-based research and analysis, engagement, and recommendations for action. I'm your host, Brendan Frank. Today, we're speaking with Dwayne Bratt, a professor in the Department of Economics, Justice, and Policy Studies at Mount Royal University and a Positive Energy faculty affiliate. Dr. Bratt's latest study with Positive Energy explores the intersection of federalism, energy, and environmental policy in Canada. Energy and environmental policy cover both provincial and federal jurisdiction, which holds both opportunities for cooperation and, as the last several years have illustrated, potential for conflict. These conflicts are not new by any means, but the onset of climate change has intensified disagreements around areas of energy and environmental policy. Dwayne's forthcoming paper for Positive Energy explores the history of these dynamics, the complexities that can arise, and offers some recommendations for a way forward. He's here to discuss. Welcome, Dwayne.
Hey, Brendan.
So how do you understand the intersection of federalism and energy and environmental policy?
So for several years, I've given an assignment in my class talking about and this focuses on international policy. One of their assignments that they could choose to do was about energy environment coordination with the United States. And I would often get a student going, well, I just want to write about the environment, or I just want to write about energy. And I said, you can't, because they're intrinsically linked. You can't discuss energy policy without talking about the environment. And I don't think you can really talk about environmental policy without looking at energy. And that's because the production and consumption of energy is a major component of greenhouse gases. And so if you're going to deal with the environment, you better address the energy file. And if you want to promote energy development, you better have a climate change plan as part of that. So the reason I think it's important is because these two issues are fundamentally linked.
And what was the motivation for this study? Why was this the time to write it?
I think there's been a number of really high profile cases that illustrate the challenge that we've got in dealing with energy and the environment. Not just in a single jurisdiction, but across jurisdictions, across Canada and in its federal structure. You can see the fights over pipelines that move from one province to another, the Trans Mountain Pipeline, or the lawsuits that Ontario, Saskatchewan, and Alberta have filed against the carbon tax. And so given these federal fights, which have existed in the past but seem to be accelerating, it was important to look at this.
So you just gave a list of contemporary examples, but I was hoping you could describe the history of this arrangement between Ottawa and the provinces. What are the roots of these challenges?
Well, someone who lives in the prairies, I would begin with 1930, when Alberta and Saskatchewan became provinces in 1905. Unlike the founding provinces, they didn't have natural resources rights. And that was a long-standing battle that took decades before it was resolved in 1930. So you can go back an awful lot of years to find this clash between the federal government and the provincial government. And then we can see the issues over Churchill Falls, the large hydro project, and the battle between Newfoundland and the province of Quebec. It's not always between the federal government and a provincial government. Often it's between provincial governments. The National Energy Program, which is now 40 years old, still resonates in the province of Alberta. And it has taken on a mythology probably greater than the actual application of the policy. So we've got these historical examples. The Kyoto Protocol in the late 1990s, same sort of stuff. So this has been an ongoing fight for decades in this country over energy, the environment, and the various orders of government, but it seems to be accelerating in more recent times.
So if we think about common themes across all of these cases, what are they? What emerges? What makes cooperation on energy and environment so difficult?
So I think there's a couple. First is the constitutional makeup of the country, you know, that divides responsibilities to the federal government and to the provincial government. So natural resources, as I said, are provincial matters. But when it crosses provincial boundaries, then it becomes a federal matter. So if it's an oil pipeline, if it's a electricity transmission line, then the federal government plays a role. The other is the whole issue of the environment was not conceived of as being an important issue in 1867 with the British North American Act. And therefore, it's not contained in the Constitution. So it is seen as a joint jurisdiction. And that joint jurisdiction leads to an awful lot of difficulty. What is the role of the federal government in environmental issues? And what is the role of the provincial government? We're going to hear a lot more about that with the Supreme Court case around carbon tax, because the federal government is arguing that climate change cannot be addressed at a provincial level, it needs to be addressed at a national level. And the provinces are arguing, if you take that, then you're getting into a slippery slope where all the federal government would have to do is say, this is dealing with an environmental concern, and they can intrude into all sorts of provincial jurisdictions. And so that is at the root of it. And we're hoping we'll get some clarity from the Supreme Court on who has primary responsibility around the environment.
We are definitely on the frontier of climate federalism right now.
Yeah. The Constitution, though, is only one aspect of that. To understand energy policy in this country, you have to understand what are the sources of energy used across the country, because they are very different. So when we look at oil and gas production, it's really Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Newfoundland. And even amongst those three provinces, Alberta represents 90% of it. When we look at natural gas, BC has a bit more natural gas, so we've now got an additional province. But Alberta is still the dominant natural gas producer. We shift to electricity. Quebec, Manitoba, British Columbia, very strong hydro provinces. Ontario has a large nuclear fleet. New Brunswick has a nuclear reactor, but we still see coal production in Saskatchewan. We still see coal production in Alberta. We still see coal being used in Nova Scotia. So to understand energy policy, we have to understand that its usage, its production ranges across the country, and that has another federal challenge to it.
So I was hoping you could talk a little bit more about the linkages between this paper and your previous study for Positive Energy, which looked at the Alberta Climate Leadership Plan.
Yeah, I think this leads a natural progression. Alberta was a case study. It focused on one province, but you couldn't look at Alberta in isolation without looking at some of these federal episodes. So in that paper, I talked about the creation of the Pan-Canadian Framework, which brought a price on carbon across the country. I don't believe could have been done if Alberta hadn't introduced its own carbon tax prior to that. Likewise, the Notley government, I think, helped to force the Trudeau government to purchase the Trans Mountain Pipeline to get it built between Alberta and British Columbia. Jason Kenney and the UCP fought against the NDP, fought against the carbon tax, gets elected. They quickly repeal the carbon tax. The federal backstop kicks itself in. And then Alberta, as I mentioned earlier, is now suing Ottawa over that carbon tax. So even though I was looking at a case study of a province, there really was a lot of federalism that was part of that. So when I finished that project, I thought, well, let's go deeper into this. And when we look at other provinces, we see other examples. It's not an Alberta versus Ottawa story. We're seeing issues, as I mentioned, over Churchill Falls between Quebec and Newfoundland. The battle over Trans Mountain was not necessarily between Alberta and Ottawa. It was between Alberta and British Columbia. You're seeing, on the other hand, some cooperation on the transmission of electricity between Manitoba and Saskatchewan. There's discussion about electricity transmission going from Quebec to Ontario. So I wanted to build on the Alberta study to say that this is a much larger issue. It's really a Canadian story.
Okay. I was hoping we could zero in a little bit more on the carbon tax court case, if you could put on your prognosticator hat. So what are the potential implications for climate federalism moving forward, depending on the outcome of that case?
I think they are huge. If we look at the decisions that were made in Saskatchewan, that were made in Ontario and Alberta, there's a reason that this is sitting at the Supreme Court, because the Saskatchewan court and the Ontario court ruled in favor of the federal government, but did not do so unanimously. It was a split decision. In the case of Alberta, they saw it in a very different mind. The Alberta court argued that no, Alberta, the provincial governments have jurisdiction over this. So that's why we're in the Supreme Court now. I think it is very significant, because if the Supreme Court rules in favor of the provinces, they're saying there is no national mandate to address climate change, or if there is, it can only be done in coordination with, or with the permission of, or the support of the provinces. If, on the other hand, the Supreme Court rules in favor of the federal government, that does give them a national mandate. I actually think, and this is just a bit of an aside, I can see a situation of the Supreme Court ruling in favor of Ottawa that the Alberta government, which campaigned against repealing the provincial carbon tax, would reintroduce a provincial carbon tax because they would be able to control the money instead of Ottawa. So that would just be one aspect of the implications of that. The question would be, is it very narrow on the issue of the carbon tax, or would that give license for greater federal intrusion into provincial jurisdiction under the shield of addressing climate change? So road construction, what uses roads? Cars use roads. So could the federal government argue that because cars produce greenhouse gas emissions, that therefore the federal government should be administering roads and highways? I don't think so, but depending on how broadly the court rules, you could see some of these sorts of scenarios. So is it a narrow ruling in favor of the federal government? That would have one set of implications. If it's a broad ruling in favor of the federal government, that has another set of variables. And if they rule in the province's case, then what does that mean? Does that mean we have a patchwork quilt across the country dealing with climate change? And if some provinces decide that they're not going to do anything, that's okay. A lot is on the line with this case.
It is the latest frontier in energy and environment federalism, but it won't be the last. And your paper offers a really great set of concrete recommendations for charting a path forward, seizing policy windows. And I was hoping you could give us a preview of some of those recommendations without spoiling too much.
Yeah, that was the toughest part of the paper. It's easy to identify the problem, and it's easy to identify the various cases, historical and current cases, that explain the problem. It's easier. You can even then go at the roots of this, as I did with the Constitution and the various energy drivers, province by province. Coming up with solutions is much tougher. And ultimately, this is going to involve intergovernmental cooperation. It is going to involve cooperation between the federal government and the provincial governments. And I think there's several ways of doing that, both theoretically, but also with some historical parallels. The first is a multilateral approach. And this is when we have an agreement made with the federal government and almost all of the provinces, either all of them or close to being all of them. That is tough to achieve, as you can imagine, in any context, to get all the provinces and the federal government to agree over anything. But we had seen the Pan-Canadian Framework. When the Pan-Canadian Framework came in 2016, it had the support of the federal government and all the provinces but Saskatchewan. Then we saw elections occur, and Ontario pulls out after the election of Doug Ford. Rachel Notley and the NDP had already pulled out in a dispute over Trans Mountain, but Jason Kenney wasn't going to re-enter it. So while they had a temporary arrangement where they had consensus, that consensus broke down. Some skeptics would say that's an inherent problem, and that's why we should never pursue multilateralism. I disagree. I think there was a great achievement with the Pan-Canadian Framework. Much of that policy has remained in effect. And depending on how the Supreme Court rules on the carbon tax, there's other elements of the Pan-Canadian Framework, then that will stand the test of time, despite these reversals in various provincial governments. But it's finding that opportunity, what I call a window of opportunity, using Kingdon's policy windows approach, where there are certain moments in time where the stars align. And in 2016, where the stars aligned was a newly elected Liberal government that had campaigned on climate change, that had even put in their election platform putting a price on carbon. They walk into a situation where Ontario, BC, Quebec, and then Alberta all had some sort of carbon pricing. Alberta, the largest oil and gas producer, had just introduced one. You still had Barack Obama in the White House in the United States, who supported climate change. You had the Paris Climate Summit in 2015. So there were all these events coming together, and Justin Trudeau was able to be a policy entrepreneur, to use some of Kingdon's language, and bring it all together. And while there has been some reversals, much of that plan still remains in place. So what it requires is a skilled politician to recognize when those forces have come together and to take full advantage of them. Because if you tried to do something where those conditions were not there, such as over the Kyoto Protocol in the late 1990s, where they tried to achieve a consensus which didn't have these windows of opportunity in place, it didn't work. Likewise, though, I often say that next to the window of opportunity is the trapdoor of disaster. That, and you saw that with the Meech Lake Accord, where Brian Mulroney did see this window, was able to get a unanimous agreement on the Constitution that quickly disintegrated and led to a separation referendum in the province of Quebec and the tossing out of the Mulroney government and the end of the Progressive Conservative Party and all of those sorts of things. So just because you can find that window doesn't necessarily guarantee success, but it is an opportunity. And I use that illustration of the Pan-Canadian Framework.
Well, it is a fascinating piece of research, and we look forward to sharing it in the near future. Dwayne Brett, thank you very much.
Thanks, Brendan.
You've been listening to the Positive Energy Podcast. To see more of our research and to find out about upcoming events, check out our website. Today's episode was produced by Alicia Aziz, Raphael Desordi, and myself, Brendan Frank. We'll be back in a few weeks. See you soon.